Welcome back, folks, to another episode of the Business from the Bass Boat podcast on the Sirius Angler Network. And guys, today, great show lined up. Just want to make sure our mic's all good here. Don't have audio. There we go. All right. Anyways, so folks, just got back from the Toyota Series Championship. And figured I would do a solo show talking about hacks for the traveling tournament angler. But first, we'll break down a little bit of what I saw at the Toyota Series Championship, where I finished, how I caught them, how I didn't catch them, all of that kind of details. I've had some people message me about that. It's like, gosh, I need to talk more about my own fishing too, not just stuff in the industry and everything else. So anyways, if you missed it, great show last week that happened while I was at the Toyota Series Championship with Advanced Bass Stats. Cool to hear how he kind of builds some of that information. And you see the breakdown right now between all the different tournament series and everything. And so it's been neat to be able to interview some of these folks in the industry doing some of these really cool things, because I mean, we're all bass geeks here and take interest in it. But anyways, Toyota Series Championship. So moved to Idaho from Colorado. So I think it made for a 23 hour drive to Table Rock Lake. And gosh, I have been really busy with this move, everything else. And I just told myself, like, I don't really want to go into this place with preconceived notions. You know, I think especially as a angler, when you start fishing at a higher level, I'm certainly not at a, I don't even consider it a super, super high level, but when you start going and branching out and going to different places, you want to do as much research and all this stuff. And I have struggled personally, like once you develop kind of your own instincts and way of fishing, I feel like this year I've had some success in the Western Toyota Series by not really going with preconceived notions, like having an idea of things and what could happen, but not really spending a bunch of time nitpicking Google Earth study, all that stuff. Like I've done all of that in the past, and it just is like, still you have to find them when you're there, right? And so I think it can all play a role, and you got to find what works for you. But anyways, I really had no preconceived notions for this one. I didn't talk to anyone. You know, what's been cool, Colorado, there's been a couple of guys that have moved down to that Table Rock region. Didn't really even talk to those guys about conditions of the lake or anything. It's just like, man, I'm going to go down. And of course, that was also, there's an off limits for a week before. But anyways, you could get a lot of information in the Toyota Series. That's just kind of a given. But I just went there with no preconceived notions, see what we can find. And it was really fun the first 2 days pre-frontal. So we had 4 days of practice, we had an off day, and then we had a three-day tournament if you made the final day. So those first 2 days, it was, man, pretty lights out. My first three bites, it was like a 2.78 spot, a 2.7 largemouth, a 3.5 spot. Like it was like, holy cow, like this place has got some fish, and they were biting, they were aggressive, and it was like, man, here we go. Front hits, all of that really shut down and was tough. So I had a couple of things that I had found and practiced, and I find myself more and more with forward-facing sonar fishing slower in practice. And I think I kind of got to get out of that in some instances. Like before, right, you don't really know what you're looking at. You're just kind of covering water when you're actually fishing. Now I find myself more than anything picking up the trolling motor and looking around on scope, right? And spending time breaking stuff down that way rather than with side scan and things. And I still utilize side scan in this to find brush piles. But anyways, you still get such a dang good picture with live. And that's what you're seeing more and more guys do, mounting them to the back of the boat. I mean, a co-angler I was staying with in this tournament, his non-boater was out in the ocean chasing, right, these suspended roaming fish. And he had two live scope transducers off of the back of his boat, and then one up at the front, right, on his trolling motor. But the co-angler was literally able to see out each side on the jack plate, It's just a beam, right? Like he could literally make a cast out of fish. It's wild. So anyways, a lot to unpack just around that, but the bite was pretty hot. I had a good topwater bite happening in the morning, those first couple of days and towards the end of the day. I had an A rig working for me around timber. That was definitely a thing. Like there would be some largemouth for the most part, all three species, but I seem to catch a lot of largemouth on the timber in 20, 30 feet of water. And you'd just be, you know, almost the Patrick Walters on, Fork and those types of places. Like I was just looking around and sometimes I could see them, sometimes I couldn't. And I'd throw that A rig over and it was nice because you can watch it to where you're not getting snagged. Certainly still get snagged, but you're really paying attention to like pull it up and over trees and those kinds of things. And every once in a while, I want to come out and hammer it. And so that was happening. A single swim bait bite I was getting bit on. And then I chased some of those roaming fish. So that front hit and it was freezing, right? It was 20s at night, 40s during the day. It rained. And then it was like just that post frontal cold slick. Like this is going to be a grind. And that's when it got a lot tougher. And a lot of that stuff wasn't really happening. I had no topwater bites really after that front hit. And I think some guys did, but gosh, there was a good bite happening before that. So that all kind of shut down. I could still get bit on the A-rig some. And then I found a rock pile and I got bit on a jig by a nice smallmouth. And there was like six or seven smallmouth with him on scope, right? Like I had to hook a fish. And of course, in practice, a lot of times I pan back over to see, hey, are there more with it? What kind of a mark does this look like? You know, that's what's so cool about everything we have now. So I kind of in my head was like, I'm probably going to spend a lot of time with an A-rig and then also a jig. And I love kind of going to that tournament morning because you don't really know what's going to work better. And in my head, I thought it was going to be mostly the A-rig. And it turned out day one, I caught a lot of my fish on a jig. And that was on rock piles. I found a couple of stumps that I could throw, isolated stumps that I threw a jig to and caught some nice fish off of. And the A-rig deal, the unfortunate thing, as you just know with it, you get so many follows, right? So it's just like, it's a frustrating deal because you throw it over a brush pile and there'd be eight of them that come out and look at it. And every once in a while, especially if it's the right window, bite window, like there certainly was something happening in the evening, afternoon, one would snap on it and it was probably a pretty good one. And so I mixed it up, did that on day one, and I had two bites first thing. Two nice smallmouth I put in the boat on the jig. And then, I struggled until I got a keeper largemouth middle of the day on the rig. And then I continued out into the area where I just found this area that had some shad in it. And so for me, I guess I should break down a little bit more of practice. So I was getting bit in timber. I was getting bit on brush piles. I was getting bit on rock piles in that like mid-depth. I could go up on the bank and get a bite every once in a while, but it wasn't consistent for me. And then out in the middle of nowhere chasing bait, which was how 75% of the field really caught them, right? I could go out there and if I got around bait, I was catching some small fish and I did catch one really big spot doing that to where like, I mean, literally bait ball, bass under the bait ball, and pitched over a Damiki rig, went through the bait ball, he ate it, and it was a nice spot. This is all in practice. So I never found any of the super deep stuff that was happening like guys were talking about. Like, so for me, whenever I found the bait, it could be in the back of a creek. It generally was close to a channel, but it could be all the way into a channel. It could be in the main river channel, right? Like that was a big consistent thing. You run down the lake, you're like dodging boats because guys are just out in the middle of the, you know, the White River channel on Table Rock. And so anyway, beautiful lake, really cool to see this place. I never figured out that like guys were talking about some largemouth and stuff being in 50, 60 feet of water. And again, this you could be out there over 180 feet and there's bass chasing them right out there. And so I never found the deeper than like 20 to 30. So like the shad balls might only be 10 feet under the surface or to the surface or 20 feet down. But, and then you'd see three or four with them or under that shad ball that were those bass. And so it was really cool to fish that way. I've never fished that way before. really hard to do in the wind. That's what I was impressed with some of the guys on day two, because I tried some of it in day two and they were killing chat around me and I could not get them to go. But it was really hard to look at them on your trolling motor and on scope in the wind, because it's not like you're just looking at a brush pile or a rock pile. Like, you need to be looking all directions, but as you're looking all directions, the boat's spinning because of the wind. And it was really difficult. Felt bad for my co-angler in that situation, because you're just like, oh, making a cast behind the boat because you see four over here, and you really needed something pretty heavy to get to him quick. So tons of lessons learned from this event. But anyways, so day one, I ran the rock pile deal, the brush pile deal, caught some fish, and just, it was really good in the morning, slicked off really tough. And then at like 2 o'clock, they started really going again. And so that's where I culled a couple of times off of some stumps, off of a brush pile. I threw a shaky head into a pile that I saw a bunch around, and I couldn't get him to go with, you know, a rig or a swim bait or a jerk bait over top of them. So I slowed down a little bit and I picked up a big largemouth doing that. So weighed in 13.6 day one, was sitting in 23rd or something like that. And honestly, this was another lesson learned that I think needs to be a takeaway for anyone. Like, Toyota Series Championship, first one for me. You're nervous, you're excited, you go up on stage, and there's a lot of people at the weigh-in, everything else. And I really thought I had a bigger bag than that. Like, I weigh them like most guys do when you're culling, especially, and my scale's almost always dead on. And I had like 14.6. And so then I weigh with the cull tag. So I'm thinking, okay, I got 14.25, 14.3, something in there is how it generally always shakes out. And it had me down. It doesn't matter because I didn't catch him day two. But in the future, I know it can hurt guys to reweigh, and you need to read the regulations on this, I think. But my head now, like, doesn't matter what's going on. I'm like, everyone's happy, cheering, great job, all this. It's like, hey, man, we need to do a reweigh if that's all right. Like, just do it, because it messed with my head. Like, it really did. I was frustrated because I really thought I had a bigger bag than I did. And then you just know, right? Like, you fish enough, you know what a 3-pounder is, you look at them and you can get tricked. But like, my smallest fish on my scale was like a 2.7. So I don't know how we get to 13.5 from that. But anyways, that doesn't matter. That's just how it goes. So day two, I went back to my rock pile. I missed one on it, on the jig. It's like, it's all right, no big deal. I knew that I needed to catch a couple first thing, because then it got really tough for me. And then I could just run stuff. There was certainly a lot of pressure around the areas I was fishing. And I was running 15 brush piles a day, probably, that first day. The second day, I ran a heck of a lot more. New water, that's something I also have really learned about traveling, is like, I try and at least hit some new water every day during the tournament. Just trying to run into something can save your tournament. So I didn't have anything on my morning stuff. I missed a couple fish, but like, those fish were all still there. Like, that's what bothers me, is like, in today's technology, like, those same rock piles and brush piles, there was less of them. They would still follow stuff, but like, those same fish were there, and I could not get them to go. And I tried and tried and come back to them, you know, 2-3 different times, different baits, and just trying to make it happen, really finessing down and drop shotting. And so those fish were really finicky, I think, especially in those piles, because a lot of the Missouri lakes, there's the public fishing like data on their habitat and piles. And so you can download this and just run them, and they have fish in them. Like, I've caught some really nice fish in this practice and tournament out of their public, you know, brush piles. And then of course, as you're sitting there fishing and you're looking around on scope, you find other ones that are maybe not off the beaten path, or are, you know, 40 yards, 50 yards, 100 yards away from that one pile. So then you have a couple of piles. So that's what was interesting. And again, for me, that mid depth was the key. Like, from 12 to 30, that's where I felt like most of the pile fish were for me. And it could be a spot, could be largemouth or smallmouth. The rock piles seemed to have much more smallmouth on them. Makes sense, right? But you never knew when you cast, especially at those fish that were pelagic and chasing bait. So day two, I'm running it. I'm trying to stay calm. And I was calm. It's not like I was starting to get crazy or anything. It's like, well, it's not really happening. It's all right. The evening bite's like good. Like I culled twice. I caught five keepers in the evening yesterday. We're going to be okay. We're going to get our five. So I'm just fishing around and I pitched under a dock with a drop shot and I watched them come out on scope and it was a smallmouth and caught it. It was a nice smallmouth keeper. I was like, all right, started running a little bit more of that, but I should have kept doing that probably. But instead I went back to the piles, chasing some of these fish just on new water, everything in between. And just could not get a bite. Like, I mean, I caught some shorts, but like then on my way back too, I had remembered seeing some birds on the run in the day before chasing bait out in the middle, right? In this drain. And so I rolled into there. Of course, it was at this point blowing probably like 20. And so it was really hard to see on scope. It was very hard to control the boat to cast these fish, but they were doing it, right? Like they were busting them out in the middle of this drain over 100 feet of water. And some of them like looked like some pretty solid ones. And I missed one on the whole Cody Huff jig and wrap deal. Missed one bite on that, and I missed one on a Dumiki, and I couldn't get any of those fish to go either. And so it's just like, it was just one of those like really frustrating days. Never really put anything together. Those fish were still there. I just couldn't make them go. I should have probably ditched them earlier and just started running docks. Like that's what the universe gave me, right? Like I pitched over a dock, caught one, and I saw another one with it. It's like, maybe I should have kept doing that. But the dock thing, right? So hit and miss. I feel like you got to run, be dedicated to it and run 100 of them and get your five throughout the day. So I bounced around too much doing different things, trying to make something happen. And that's probably a learning thing. But at the same time, like, you know, you have tournaments like that where you find something and it happens. Right. And it happens fast. And that's what I love about tournament fishing is you're one cast away at any time from changing your complete day. Like, I think that's my favorite part about tournament fishing. So struggled day two, had that one fish, you know, put me in like 98th or something, middle of the pack for 210 boat championship, but just really frustrating because I caught him good day one and really expected. I didn't think that I could go do the same bag that I had, but I felt like I could really go get a limit, and it wasn't easy by any means. I mean, there are some guys that were really catching them, but for me, practice and tournament, it was tough. Like just, and I think that was for a lot of people as far as just getting bites, but that's Toyota Series Championship. But that, a little bit a deeper dive than I probably normally do. So let me know in the comments or on podcast, or send us a DM on Serious Angler on our Instagram if you want more of these kind of breakdowns after these tournaments for myself. So, but thinking about it, it's like, okay, 24-hour drive to this tournament, probably one of the longest drives I've had. I've made some big drives from Colorado to Kentucky, Alabama, Tennessee, but from Idaho to Lake of the Ozark, or sorry, Table Rock, being 24 hours, it's like, there's definitely some takeaways that I have learned on travel, has been on the road as much as I have the last couple of years, that I think are beneficial to anglers of all levels. I think there's always tips and be able to be learning. Even if you're going to go fish your state or national or regional tournament, like there's things that you can just learn and save money on. So I wrote down a couple of those things. And I think at this point I've got it, things pretty well dialed and for myself. And I think everyone's different from that perspective, but, and you got to figure out, you know, how comfortable you want to be, how uncomfortable you want to be, who you are, your finances, all of that. So for me at this point, lodging, I'm very rarely going to go to a hotel. So for me, it's like, we're either doing an Airbnb, VRBO with a bunch of buddies. That's an option always. And yeah, you're probably paying a little bit more than you would, obviously camping, and, or if you have friends in an area. But the three ways that I lodge on the road are either Airbnb, VRBO with buddies. In this case, it was great because I'm very grateful. It was the camaraderie. It was fun. It was a bunch of guys from out west in Utah and Colorado and some of my closest friends. And so it was a great time to spend time with everyone and, you know, suffer through the conditions together and all of that, but not have to worry about camping in the cold too, which I've done plenty of hunting and fishing. And it's like, it was nice to go in and take a hot shower. And I do all of that camping too, but it still sucks when it's raining. Like, that's the worst part about camping. If it's raining, like, there's nothing to do unless you have the full truck bed camper set up or the fifth wheel. When you're just in a vehicle, it's like, gosh, this sucks. Like, what can we even do? So to me at this point, it's like staying with a group at an Airbnb, Vrbo, friends. Like, that's something that has been so rewarding and cool to me, is traveling the country, fishing tournaments. It's like, you make a lot of friends in places and you develop relationships and people let you stay. Like, I mean, and that's the same thing. It's like open invitation, and there's not going to be a lot of guys, especially with like Idaho, but like, you know, like open invitation to anyone who's ever coming or going through an area. It's like, dude, like, it's not a big deal for someone to stay at the house, and you want to be obviously respectful and do what you can for those people. And, but I think that is an awesome thing to always consider. And then lastly is camping for me. Like, those are the three methods. And I've camped as long as 8-9 days before. And it's like, man, how do you do that? But really, you pick a good campsite, you pick a good area that has showers. Like, that's a thing. And yeah, like, it's kind of weird to go shower in a shower that other people are also using. But a lot of these, like, some of them are really nice. These RV parks, state park campsites can be incredible. And, you know, bring your flip flops for the shower, and it's no big deal. It's an enjoying thing for me. And I've got a group that kind of do some of that with. I've done plenty of it solo as well. And I have a truck bed camper setup, right? So I've got a F-150 with a 6.5 foot bed, and then I have a deck system. So I have the drawers, and then I sleep on top of that on an extremely comfortable mattress. Like, we're talking, I sleep so good on this thing, and it's a, it's an Exped. So EXPED is the brand, and they blow up. It's foam, but it's also air. And so it's just a really comfortable mattress. And so get that going. Obviously, if it's hot in the summer, have a fan. Some people have the little AC units. Like, that's cool too. If it's cold, figure out a heater situation, because generally you're going to be at a plug-in site, right? Because you have to plug your boat in anyway. So you do have access to electricity. So that's really nice. Generally, there's water right next to you. So a lot of benefits in my eyes to camping. It's super cheap, right? Like $25 to $40 a night, generally speaking. Sometimes it's $20 a night. Like, so that's really cool. And the other thing I love about the truck bed setup is you can get on the road if you're comfortable sleeping in places. Like, and I've learned this, good and bad. You can get on the road before or after a tournament and get 3-4 hours down the road and pull over and sleep for the night and then get back on the road. But like, you don't have to, you can break that trip up because you can kind of stop anywhere. And so there's a lot of great places to stop, and you just want to be obviously in a generally safe area. It's another thing, like, be safe out there. I have my concealed carry, and that's just like, just my thoughts on just being in the middle of nowhere in places or places you're not comfortable with, where it's legal, and make sure you have all your due diligence there. But I like the idea of being able to stop wherever. And generally I try and pick places that don't have a bunch of lights around, because I don't, my truck bed camper setup, right? I get annoyed with having lights at night. So generally places that aren't going to be super busy, but there's a bunch of, especially out west, there's so many camping places along these river systems and lakes and stuff where you can just pull in and camp. I've stopped literally on the side of the road before, where there was like a pretty good ditch and kind of a low spot, or like wherever. Like, there's so many options there, and you can kind of do your own research on what makes the most sense for you. But certainly a big advantage to me is the truck bed camper setup, and it's easy. And it's inexpensive. So if you're willing to kind of do that, I think it's a great option. So at this tournament, right, made sense to kind of stay with a group. It was a blast. Great time. Thanks to those guys for the invite. And then the other thing, my parents live in Colorado, so it was about halfway in between, almost exactly. So it was great. Stay at my parents' house, see a couple of friends and everything else, take care of some business back in Colorado. And it was like, that's another thing to really consider, is look at your route. If you know someone or a family member or something in that route, it's a 24-hour drive. I broke it up into 2 days. Like, that's, you get comfortable, I think, to driving those long distances consistently. And with that, I think if you can break it up more, the better. And then also spending as much time as you can driving during the day. Like those nighttime drives are dangerous. I've learned a ton now to like, I know when I'm getting sleepy, I'm pulling over. Like that's just, it is what it is. Like I've had too many friends get in accidents that way. And so really pay attention to yourself. And, you know, there's all kinds of tricks as far as eating crunchy foods and rolling the windows down and all kinds of these things, calling somebody. But like, if you're getting tired, like there's a few things that are, man, it's pretty dangerous. So always pull over if it's getting too bad. And even that 30 minute, 1 hour nap on the side of the road can really make a difference. And you're like, man, I feel great now. So something to consider, and also being well rested before the trip. So it sucks to do that right after a tournament, cause you're just exhausted from spending 14 hours a day and not getting very much sleep, all that kind of stuff. So those are kind of some tips around driving. As far as cost savings go for food, I try and mix it up pretty decently. So definitely do a lot of meal prep before a tournament. And that also just helps me stay healthier eating wise on the water and everything else. Is like, do a lot of meal prep. You know, rice and a protein and some vegetables in something is super easy to just stack a bunch of them up and put them in your cooler and then pull them out, pull one out for the boat each morning, got your snacks, all that kind of stuff. So I think that's a great thing to do. Another thing I've been doing lately to just being lazy around camp rather than spending an hour and a half cooking. I don't like doing these back to back because they're kind of expensive. And then also it can be, you know, hard on your gut, I think, from some of these things, but like a backpacking meal, right? Like Western hunting and backpacking have learned that the backpacking meals can be really, really good. And so just need a jet boil and pull that out of the back of the truck at camp, start it, done in 8 minutes. Then you just discard the packaging and like, that's it, right? Super easy meal. And it's generally good and warm and those kinds of things. So that's a great thing camping wise, food wise, I think that maybe not everyone is thinking about. And then as far as trying to do as much of that as you can, this case, it was great to be headed back home because my mom is an incredible, incredible lady who put together some breakfast burritos and all kinds of stuff. And like, that's just awesome when you have something like that. Food wise to have that ready to go into the week. Some one less thing to have to worry about with everything. But generally in a group like that, like we'll go out a couple of nights just to get some food, maybe have a couple of beers, those kinds of things. And I think that's important to talk with those guys and enjoy that aspect. Like we're doing this for fun, right? And so as long as you're not doing that all the time, I don't think it's a big deal. And the other thing I guess would be with friends too, it's fun to cook and do those kinds of things at a camp or at the house or whatever it may look like. So I think those are my thoughts on all of that food. Try not to spend a bunch of money at gas stations across the country as you go, right? Like you stop and you're like, oh, want a snack of this or that. And I don't think it's at the end of the world to do some of that, right? But I think gas stations, you can spend quite a bunch of money in a hurry when you hit, you know, your 12-hour day of driving, you hit 3 or 4 or 5, maybe 6 gas stations in a day. Like if you're stopping and getting a snack every time, it's like there goes $50 pretty quick. So on the gas thing, there are a lot of apps in today's world that can save you quite a bit of money on fuel. So out here, there's a lot of Sinclairs out west, and this is from Turner. Turner is was my team partner in Colorado. Sure, I'm sure we'll fish team tournament still. But anyways, he kind of showed me this Sinclair app, and it's great because when you are doing your taxes correctly as a tournament angler, if you are trying to make money at this or like trucks, for the most part, I'm writing off all those miles, but then there's boat gas. And so, and this saves on the truck gas too, but essentially the Sinclair app, if you're using your debit card attached to their app, you're saving 20 cents a gallon generally. at every one of their stops. So that's really cool. Looking in your route, kind of like, hey, there's, you know, in advance or while I'm driving, I'll look and be like, in Missouri, you know, gas is going to be under $3. Well, that's where I'm going to fill the boat, right? Like, that's where I'm going to put 50 gallons in. And that's where I'm going to try and fill as much as I can and try to avoid those stops that are not the same. So certainly a lot of savings around fuel in the apps. You can still use credit cards in some of those apps and save 10, 20 cents off a gallon. I think those are big things when we're talking about as much fuel as we're using with this. Oh, I remember what I was going to say about food. So another thing, just from a tax perspective, and I'm definitely not a CPA, but just you can write off those meals while you're traveling and working and networking. So I don't view the food expense as such a negative because generally I'm writing off those expenses around eating out with friends. And that is making sure to keep your receipts and do all your tax stuff from that perspective. But the other big thing for me that has been incredibly helpful and have people to thank around this is leaving your boat at places. And this is something I learned from Ty Faber, especially as he leaves boats all over the country. And it makes it so much easier to either just drive back to a place because you can go really fast, right? Pulling, you're just driving without a boat on the back, much less to worry about. And you're not putting as much wear and tear on your trailer. So if you have people that you trust and know, and someone that has room on the side of their house, or maybe they've got a shop, or maybe they've got some acreage and you can go stick it back behind their shop or whatever it is. So all of that is huge and is so helpful. And just have so many people to thank that I have left my boat at places, and sometimes boat and truck at places, and then flown back. Like, right. Like, that's another huge advantage if you can be without your boat for a couple of weeks or a month. So, like, you know, I look at the schedules, how can you get the most bang for your buck? If you are trying to fish a bunch of tournaments, it's like, if, you know, last year, the Toyota Series in California, there was one of the Delta and then another one of the Delta within, I think, a month of each other or something pretty close like that. So left my whole truck and boat out there. And I know that's not realistic for everyone, and you'd have to have a vehicle to borrow back home or another vehicle or whatever that looks like. But I think that that is a great way to save on time and expenses just around things is leaving that boat, leaving that truck and boat at places. I don't like leaving stuff at the airport. I feel like airports get broken into, cars get broken into all the time, and it's generally pretty expensive. So I try and figure out a way to leave it at someone that I know. The other option is always at the lakes that you're going to. So say I'm headed to California and there's the Delta and Clear Lake a couple hours apart. You know, if it's a place that I'm going to go to, I will take my boat there. And if I don't have someone where I can leave it there or nearby, you can reach out to these marinas, different boat storage places that are right there, and leave it there for a month. Somewhere where it's locked up, secured. So you just know that your stuff's going to be there when you come back. So another great way to save from that perspective. But I think that's about all my tips as far as travel that I've learned over the years. You know, I really enjoy being on the road. I really do. I think that is something that I have always loved and enjoy staying busy and staying driving. And so certainly a part of my life that I really, really like and value, and I'm sure some of you do as well. So hopefully this helps as far as anyone who is fishing, trying to fish at a high level. Maybe you already are fishing at a way higher level than even I am, or you're like, hey, I do those couple bigger tournaments here. Even if you're fishing at the club level, right? Like, you're still traveling often and a lot, and camping or, you know, figuring out your lodging at places. I think this is so applicable to so many people, kayak guys, like all of it, right? So hopefully this is some tips, just personal experiences and tips that I have learned, and also broke down a little bit of the Toyota Series Championship. Guys, so Bass Fishing Electronics right now is running a kind of pre-Black Friday sale. So check out everything from them. They've got discounts on their actual milled and metal accessories, as well as electronics and everything else there. So certainly pay attention to that. Do it molds. Obviously, we are getting into the winter season. Guys are winterizing their boats up north. It's time to spend that time, you know, pouring jigs, pouring jig heads, messing with tackle. It's a fun time of the year. I just pulled all my rods out of the boat and have like got rods that are broke and just going through tackle and all that. So certainly always help our friends out at Do It Molds from a certainly a good way to save some money and really make some awesome, awesome custom tackle. And then lastly, if you missed the Rec Lending episode, Rec Lending's doing a giveaway that's going through the end of the year. So anyone who is in the market for a boat, or you have a boat and are looking to save from financing perspective, get on this giveaway. It is, they're not going to sell your information. Yes, they have to run a soft credit pull to do this information, but they're using that as leverage to go to the bank to get everyone a better deal, including yourself. And they're going to have your interest at the highest point when interest as in not interest rate, but like the best interest in you when it's time to refinance at the right time. So those are just ways, I think, to pay attention in the off season, but also helping our sponsors out. So any of that would be great. And if you guys have any other questions for me around tackle, or I guess I shouldn't say tackle, but what I do in the off season, that'd be some interesting shows as far as tackle stuff. You need to dive more into that with Bailey and Andrew and everything else. But anyways, guys, thanks for tuning in. Another great episode, and we've got a lot coming up, and hope everyone has a great Thanksgiving in the coming weeks. It's a great time to also be on the water if you can still get out and things aren't super iced up. With that, guys, have a good one.